The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Can you tell us who did it?
No. I could, but I'm not going to.
Because everybody assumes it's the Chinese.
I've read that, too.
And I want to get to every single metropolitan area in this, major metropolitan area in this country that has a significant Muslim population, to talk to Muslim community leaders about helping us if they see somebody going in the wrong direction. As Jim said last night, it's almost always the case that there is someone else who knows.
Sony in some ways encapsulated everything we had seen before. Theft of intellectual property, theft of personally identifiable information, destructive activity, the use of a nation state to use cyber as a coercive tool.
I'm EJ Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, July 25th, 2015. I have seized control of the Lawfare Podcast in a bloodless coup, and in the spirit of summer fun, I'm doing the introduction this week. That first voice you heard was FBI Director Jim Comey. The second was DHS Secretary Jay Johnson. Rounding out the trio was NSA Chief Admiral Mike Rogers. All were speaking this week at the Aspen Security Forum, which kindly allowed us to edit and create an audio montage of these three events. Interviewing Comey is CNN's Wolf Blitzer. Interviewing Johnson is The New Yorker's Ryan Lizza. And David Sanger of The New York Times interviews Rogers in an audio with a lot of unfortunate glitches, for which we apologize. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 133, Comey, Johnson, and Rogers speak at Aspen.
What keeps you up at night?
Trying to decide whether to wear a tie to the Aspen Institute or not. What keeps me up at night is probably these days the ISIL threat in the homeland, and I worry very much about what I can't see. That's what keeps me up.
What you don't know, obviously you don't know.
Yeah, our task is, if you imagine a nationwide haystack, we're trying to find needles in that haystack, and a lot of those needles are invisible to us, either because of the way in which they're communicating or just because they haven't communicated or touched a place where we could see them. And knowing that there are needles out there that you can't see is very worrisome.
Now, you say ISIL. Some of us say ISIS. Some of us say Islamic State. It's all the same thing. Is that now a bigger threat to the U.S. homeland than al-Qaeda?
Yes. Yeah. The threat that ISIL poses to the United States is very different in kind, in type, in degree than al-Qaeda. ISIL is not your parents' al-Qaeda. It's a very different model. And by virtue of that model, it's currently the threat that we're worrying about in the homeland most of all.
Why is ISIS so powerful?
Well, they have adopted a model that takes advantage of social media in a way to crowdsource terrorism. They have invested about the last year in pushing a message of poison, primarily through Twitter, but other parts of social media, that is a siren song with two dimensions. They are preaching through social media to troubled souls, urging them to join their so-called caliphate in Syria and Iraq, or if you can't join, kill where you are. And Twitter is a valuable enterprise because it works to sell shoes or to sell ideas. It works to sell this message to troubled souls. Again, I talk about your parents, Al-Qaeda, and I mean to convey the sense that the model is just totally different, right? With Al-Qaeda, if you wanted to consume their propaganda, you had to go find it somewhere on the web. You'd read their magazine. If you wanted to talk to a terrorist, you might send an email in to their magazine and hope that somebody answers you. ISIL has changed that model entirely because ISIL is buzzing on your hip, right? That message is being pushed all day long. And if you want to talk to a terrorist, they're right there on Twitter direct messaging for you to communicate with. And so they've invested in months and months of pushing this message, and it resonates with troubled souls, with young folks and with troubled older people. It's the reason we have these investigations all across the United States. That year of investment is producing a warped view of the world on the part of a lot of people who either want to travel to the caliphate or kill where they are. And my job, along with a lot of our partners, is to find the travelers and stop them, and most urgently to stop those who want to kill where they are.
You think you have a pretty good appreciation of how many Americans have actually gone over there and trained with ISIS?
I think we have a reasonable idea. It's not a high confidence read because there's lots of ways to get to Syria, but I think we have a pretty good sense.
How many?
I'll give you dozens of people have gone with ISIL to ISIL. Again, it's a hard phenomenon to track because they range in age from 18 to 62. People have gone over to join up with ISIL. And so I think we have a reasonable handle on that. Their going there is very worrisome. Their inevitably coming back if they survive the battlefield is more worrisome still.
These are men and women, right?
Yes. Primarily men, but increasingly young women drawn to that siren song that's buzzing on their Twitter feed, that this is some sort of wonderland where they can live a life of glory in the caliphate.
What's the biggest stumbling block you have right now? Because we were talking about the encrypted communications, the dark side, that some of these young people have now. And you can't get access to that, can you?
Right. That's what I'd say, one of two stumbling blocks in these cases. The first is the technological one. ISIL's MO is they'll broadcast on Twitter, get people to follow them, then move them to Twitter direct messaging while they evaluate whether they're a potential live one, either to travel or to kill where they are. Then they'll move them to an encrypted mobile messaging app where they go dark to us. And so that's what I mean by the needle becoming invisible. We can, with court authority, get access to the Twitter contacts, but we don't have the ability to break strong encryption. And so if they move to the mobile messaging app, we're going to lose them. So that's a huge worry.
What do you need now legally in order to get access to that? Because as you know, there's a big controversy. A lot of people who don't want their privacy infringed on, they don't want you to have access to that.
We need what the FBI needs in all of our investigations, right? If we want to listen to that communication or intercept the content flowing back and forth, we've got to get a court order. So we go to a judge, or if it's sitting on a device, we go to a judge for a search warrant. But the problem we're facing is even with judicial orders, which is at the core of our work, we are unable to find out what people are talking about when we've demonstrated probable cause to believe they are terrorists or they are serious criminals.
Why is that?
Because of the nature of the encryption. We don't have the ability to break the strong encryption. Now, I'm a fan of strong encryption, right? That's the challenge we all face. There's two values in conflict. All of us believe in safety and security on the internet, right? Hugely important to protecting all of us. All of us also believe in public safety. Those two things are coming into tension. We have to, as a country, figure out how to resolve them. We share the same values. We care about both. They're crashing together. We have to resolve it.
Who's stopping you from getting access to that encrypted, those encrypted messages that may, in fact, be terror-related?
Well, the way in which the mobile messaging app, for example, has been designed stops us by virtue of its design. Right? It is end-to-end encrypted, so without the key at one of the two devices, at the user end, you have no ability with a court order to intercept and look at that communication. So it's the nature of the technology that's stopping it.
So do you want the software manufacturers to allow some sort of key that will give you that kind of access once you get a court order?
The answer is I don't know exactly. I can picture the end state we need. We need judges' orders to be complied with. Now, how to figure that out? Lots of people, smart people, tell me, oh, it's too hard. I don't buy that. I don't think we've tried hard enough yet. If we recognize that we all share the same values, I think smart people can figure out how to do it. And it may not be the same for every company, right? The goal of the government is clear. We need to, with the right showing to a judge, be able to get access to the information in those targeted individual cases. How a company does it, it may depend upon the company's business model, right? There are companies out there now that encrypt their data in motion and are able to comply with judges' orders because they see the content of the communication because it's part of their business model. We need to figure out how to achieve the end goal, but the government ought not to be telling people this is the way you ought to do it because we don't know their business well enough or the technology.
So this is a whole new world for the FBI right now, right?
I think it's a whole new world for all of us.
Do you have enough people, experts, to deal with this?
I guess I hate to sound like a typical manager. I never have enough. I've got a huge group of great people. The problem here is not my people or the people in the private sector. The problem is we have not gotten our best brains together to say, so how could we maximize both of these values, safety and security on the internet and public safety?
I know you say ISIS or ISIL is the biggest terror threat to the U.S. homeland right now. AQAP, Al-Qaeda, some of the other offshoots of Al-Qaeda, still a major threat. The Khorasan group, that's a big threat right now right?
The Khorasan group is a group that is an Al-Qaeda-aligned group. It's a name given to a particular group of operatives.
Because yesterday the Pentagon said the U.S. Killed the leader of the Khorasan group.
I don't know what they've said. I guess all I'll say is that our military brothers and sisters have done a fabulous job of protecting the country by targeting terrorists around the globe, including that group.
The Khorasan group, the guy they said killed Muhsin al-Fadli in a U.S. airstrike, he's the one who was apparently plotting attacks not against people in the Middle East, but against people here in the United States. That was the main mission of the Khorasan group. I think back in September, you thought some sort of attack could be potentially imminent. That was the word you used, right?
They were a very serious threat to the United States, more in sort of the classic Al-Qaeda model, airplane-based, sophisticated, long-tail, long-planning and surveillance-type operation.
Is that threat from the Khorasan group in the United States to the American homeland still imminent, or have they been diminished in their capability?
They've been diminished by virtue of the work done by our great military. Now, it hasn't gone away, but they've been significantly diminished.
Well, that's news. That's important. Yeah. You told us recently that you and your colleagues thwarted a July 4th attack or attacks, right?
Correct.
What can you tell us about that?
Not much. There were a number of, and what's interesting about the ISIL model there, too, is the normal terms of inspired, directed, or enabled blend together with ISIL because they're just pushing. They're like a devil on somebody's shoulder saying, kill, kill, kill all day long. So figuring out whether someone was directed or inspired or enabled is actually a waste of time in many cases. There were a number of people who were bent on engaging in attacks in the United States, killing innocent people, timed to the July 4th holiday. And thanks to great work, not just by the FBI, but by our partners in state and local and federal law enforcement, it was disrupted.
Disrupted, and you say, go ahead. Were these ISIS or ISIL-related threats?
Yes.
And that's why you've concluded now that ISIS represents the major threat to the U.S. homeland as far as terrorism is concerned.
Right. And one of the reasons I say that is the sheer volume. Right? Again, I have investigations, the FBI's investigations related to this threat all across the country. Right? There are hundreds of investigations. We're trying to understand where somebody is on the spectrum between a consumer of this poison on Twitter to an actor who's about to try and murder innocent people and evaluate where are they on that spectrum. We have hundreds of people we're looking at on that spectrum. The ISIL tweeters in Syria have 21,000 English language followers. Hundreds of those people, probably thousands, are in the United States. So our job in the law enforcement community is figuring out, so who are they? And where are they along this line from consuming to acting? And that's why this is our dominant threat that we face today.
Can you monitor all those people?
Of course not. Right? Our challenge is finding them all in that haystack. As I said, even if I can find one that ISIL has concluded is a live one and that I think is a live one, our investigators often lose them because they move to a mobile messaging app that is encrypted end to end.
We've been told repeatedly that Mohammed Yusuf Abdulaziz, the Chattanooga killer, was under no threat warnings or threat lists or terror lists, no watch lists or anything like that. He wasn't on anyone's radar. Is that right?
We have no indication he's ever crossed our screen or anybody else's screen in the intelligence community.
Which is so frightening to think there could be others like him out there.
Of course.
Even if he's had some depression, some mental issues, he also potentially is inspired or whatever to go ahead.
And the people that ISIL's trying to reach are people that al-Qaeda would never use as an operative.
Why is that?
Because they are often unstable, troubled drug users. And ISIL also does something that al-Qaeda would never do. They'll vet an operative by tasking them, right? Give them an assignment, go kill somebody, as a way of checking out whether they are a real person or an informant of some kind.
So when ISIS publicly puts out there in social media, if you can't come over to Iraq and Syria and fight with us, go out there and kill U.S. military personnel or law enforcement officers, you take that seriously?
Very.
And there are current investigations underway right now, I assume, not just in New York or Washington or L.A., but I believe you've said all over the country.
All 50 states. We have hundreds of these investigations.
And the FBI is the lead in all these investigations?
Sure, but we're able to do it because we have partners in the federal government and we have over 100 joint terrorism task forces where state and local officers help us. So this is a national team effort.
So that's what really keeps you up at night?
Yes.
The major fear that you have?
Sure.
It's a real fear. Let's talk a little bit about some of these most recent incidents involving ISIS supporters. Garland, Texas. Tell us what happened there.
A group of people led by a guy named Simpson and his roommate were, again, the blending of inspired, directed, enabled comes together in this case, were consumers of the ISIL poison and decided that their mission on behalf of the Islamic State was to go and kill people at this Draw Muhammad contest in Garland, Texas.
And they succeeded to a certain degree. They
wounded one police officer, and through great work by the Garland police, they were eliminated.
It's an enormous change. Yeah. People are grateful. But there are other incidents like this, potentially, that you're investigating even as we speak right now.
Yes. Yeah, that's what I meant. We're doing this work all over the country to try and evaluate where is someone along that spectrum from consumer. Again, we know there are hundreds or thousands of consumers to actor. And the other challenge we face is, again, totally unlike your typical al-Qaeda model, is what we call the flash to bang is both short and unpredictable with ISIL. That is, often an operative will have an idea to do something, say, on July 4th, and wake up on June 2nd and say, you know, I'm not waiting. Today's the day I'm going to go kill people, which poses an additional challenge for us conducting investigations.
So I take it the biggest fear of these terror organizations coming here to the United States and wanting to kill Americans, whether ISIS or al-Qaeda or Khorasan Group or any of these organizations, these terror groups, the state-sponsored terror organizations, are they plotting here in the United States as well? I'm specifically raised the question. Go ahead and answer the question. I'll tell you why I raised it.
Tell me why you raised it, because my answer was going to be kind of a non-answer.
The reason I asked the question is because there's a huge debate underway right now about the $100 billion that Iran is about to get if they follow this nuclear deal, and that money will flow in over the next year or two. They could spend it to build hospitals and schools or bridges in Iran, or they could spend it, give it to some of their terror partners, if you will. Most of those terror partners, whether Hezbollah or Hamas or the Houthis in Yemen or in Syria, a very close partnership with the Bashar al-Assad regime, or Shiite militias in Iraq, they have their missions there. But occasionally they spread their missions overseas, and I'm wondering if you fear that some of that money could be spent launching terror strikes here in the United States by state sponsors, by organizations, for example, who may get some money from Iran.
I think all I can say about that is Iran's sponsorship of terrorism remains a focus of the entire intelligence community, including the FBI. We're responsible here in the United States. And I don't expect that threat to change, to diminish, certainly, in the wake of the additional money being available.
Did the FBI conclude that the Saudi ambassador to the United States, Adel al-Jaber, was the target of an Iranian assassination plot in Washington?
Yes.
at Cafe Milano?
Yes.
In Georgetown?
Correct.
And did the U.S. Go to the Iranians and complain about that and say, why did you want to kill the Saudi ambassador, who is now the foreign minister, by the way, of Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, I'm not going to comment on that.
But you're concerned about that. That's a potential threat out there.
I stand by what I said earlier.
Let's talk about some other areas where the FBI is deeply involved right now. As you know, the Office of Personnel Management, which is the U.S. government's agency that's in charge of all the federal employees, it's shocking to think about this, that their secure sites were hacked, and maybe 20 or 21, 22 million workers and their families, the most sensitive information, not only their social security numbers, their families, their travel, all of the information that they provided to get top secret security clearances, potentially are now in the hands of these hackers. Is that right?
Correct. And a lot of those workers are probably sitting here. One of them is sitting next to you.
You assume that the most sensitive information you provided the U.S. government when you sought security clearances, whether when you were Deputy Attorney General of the United States or working as a U.S. attorney, now the FBI director, you assume whoever hacked the computers of the Office of Personnel Management in Washington, they have all that information about you and your family.
I do. I assume that the actors in that intrusion have my SF-86 and the SF-86 is a form that anybody who wants to work for the government in a cleared position fills out, where you list, as I recall, every place you've ever lived since 18, all foreign travel, all relatives, contacts, references, jobs, basically your entire life. It's the world's most detailed resume, and everyone who's ever worked in a cleared position has filled one out. Even if you didn't get the job, if you were disqualified because of some problem on that form, that's in that database. So we have to assume that the intrusion netted those.
It's so shocking to me. And I guess the bottom line question, how could this possibly happen?
Yeah, I'm not in a position to answer that.
Can you tell us who did it?
No. I could, but I'm not going to.
Because everybody assumes it's the Chinese.
I've read that.
Last year, you compared U.S. capabilities in dealing with cybercrime, U.S. government capabilities in dealing with cybercrime. You made the analogy that these are like little kids playing soccer, and they obviously are competing against World Cup champs. You still believe that?
That's not quite what I said.
Tell us what you said.
Yeah, I was explaining that when I left government, I was in government until about 2005, our national response to soccer was a bit like, to cyber events was a bit like watching four-year-old soccer, big clumps of people chasing the ball. And where we've developed significantly, we spread out on the field, we pass to each other much better. We're against an adversary that's World Cup level, and so we have some growing to do to make sure we keep up with that threat.
Why are they so good at it, and our experts who invented all this social media stuff not necessarily that good at dealing with this cybercrime?
Well, we're very good in different parts of our world, both public and private sector. We're just not consistently good enough across that spectrum.
Who are the main cyber threats? Where do they come from right now?
The primary state actors, I don't want to give you too long a list. I'll name two, China and Russia. And then there are others.
We assume North Korea, too.
I don't want to name any others.
Why not?
I don't want to say that either. Yeah.
Is Iran one of those countries?
Yeah, I don't want to go further down the list.
Okay, but China and Russia are major threats, and they have this information. I don't know what information they have, but let's say they have sensitive information. That could be incredibly useful to them, couldn't it? Not only in terms of stealing sensitive business technology and stuff like that, but in terms of recruiting spies, and the FBI is in charge of preventing that.
You mean information like we just talked about?
Yeah.
Sure. In the hands of a state actor, it would be a goldmine for intelligence operations. You could craft recruitment strategies. You could craft the world's best spear phishing emails, right? You could send me an email that appears to be from my sister about some family event that you figured out from my background forms. with an attachment, and I would click on that attachment, and then you'd be into my system. So there's lots of ways it could be used by an intelligence agency of a foreign state actor.
It's such a chilling thought when you think about it. You just click a link, and all of your most sensitive information potentially is gone.
Right.
How do you deal with that?
Well, you deal with it by having great people, great equipment, and deploying yourself in a smart way, which, again, we've made tremendous progress on. We still got a ways to go, but we are... like I said, I meant the four-year-old soccer comparison to show what it was like back in the day and compare it to where we are today. Today, 20 of the United States' agencies sit together at an operation outside of Washington and share information at the speed of light so we can figure out who has seen what and who should respond to what. It's almost World Cup-level sharing of information. That's the answer to this threat. And working together better around the globe, because the bad guys have shrunk the globe to the size of a pinhead. Right? They've made, Beijing is next door to Boston on the internet. So we have to shrink the world back. And part of that is embedding U.S. people and personnel in our foreign partners' offices and sharing equipment and ideas to shrink it back against the bad guys.
What advice do you have for people that are listening to you right now on how to deal with this potential threat?
Well, for companies, it's fairly easy to figure out what you need to do. The basic hygiene of patching and segmenting your network and a bunch of other fancier stuff is out there. It is known. You simply got to make sure you get the people who know that to help you set up your system that way. For individuals, it's just use the common sense that you would use walking around a dark parking lot at night. Right? It's amazing how comfortable we seem at our keyboards sitting in our kitchens when we're actually wandering all over the earth potentially exposing the things that matter most to us to total strangers. So I tell folks, look, if someone knocks on your door, you're not going to open the door without looking through the peephole. An email to you is a knock on your door, right? Why on earth would you open the attachment without knowing, so who is this and where is this coming from? Understand that you are actually out in the world even though you're on your keyboard. And the same with your children, right? You wouldn't let your children go wander around a parking lot. So understand where they are in the world on the internet.
You have talked about what you call the new normal, right? Tell us what the new normal is and what is the new normal in the context of the threat from ISIS.
Well, over the last 14 years since 9/11, we've seen core al-Qaeda, as everybody knows, AQAP, the al-Qaeda-affiliated elements of al-Shabaab, which, while I was at DOD, we were focused on. In our counterterrorism efforts. We have done a lot to degrade core al-Qaeda through our good efforts. We have done a lot to degrade AQAP and al-Shabaab through our good efforts. The global terrorist threat now, as everybody knows and as Jim talked about last night, has evolved, and it has evolved in a very significant way from those groups to more groups, ISIL being the most prominent example, obviously, and it has evolved from terrorist-directed terrorist attacks to terrorist-inspired attacks. I disagree a little bit with Jim last night in that I think that the distinction between terrorist-directed and terrorist-inspired is a significant one that the American people need to understand, understand why we are where we are in our efforts. And so if you catalog the terrorist attacks and attempted attacks in this country and in Europe, for example, they almost fit neatly into one of two boxes. The terrorist-directed attacks with an operative who has been recruited, trained, directed overseas and exported to someplace else to commit a terrorist attack, to terrorist-inspired attacks, which very often, most often, involve a homegrown or even homeborn threat. And the individual has never even come face-to-face with a member of ISIL or AQ, but is inspired through the very effective use of social media to commit an attack or attempt to commit a small-scale attack. And I think the American people need to understand how we have evolved to this new phase because it does involve a whole of government approach. It does involve a lot of domestic-based efforts in addition to the good work of the FBI and in addition to taking the fight to the enemy overseas. And so we're doing a lot of things in DHS. We have enhanced our Federal Protective Service presence in a lot of federal buildings around the country. There's a presence right outside here that I don't think was here last year. That's in addition to the three wild bears that were at my door last night. We have enhanced our aviation security overseas at last point of departure airports. We are, with Frank Taylor's leadership, enhancing the information sharing with state and local law enforcement, which I think is crucial. Garland City is a perfect example of the importance of sharing what we see and what we know with state and local law enforcement so that they have the big picture. We have enhanced our CVE engagements domestically, countering violent extremism, which I know we're going to talk about a little bit more. That is a personal priority of mine. I have personally met with large numbers of Muslim leaders in this country and communities around the country, and I think that's critical to our efforts.
Before we get into CVE, first of all, I want to appreciate your security detail because I'm in the suite next to yours, so when the bears come, I'm glad they're there. I want to talk about the difference between the threat from Al-Qaeda and the threat from ISIS. I mean, in a sense, directed versus self-motivated, isn't the lone wolf or the random inspired gunman a better problem to have than the capabilities that Al-Qaeda had with the self-directed threats that plotted spectacular attacks? Or do you see ISIS moving in the same direction and that eventually that's what they'll want to do?
Well, let me answer it this way. We are facing the prospect of smaller scale attacks, given how this whole thing is evolving. But we face the prospect of that day to day in a lot of places in this country. As I think Jim pointed out, Abdulaziz was not on our radar. And I would not have considered Chattanooga, Tennessee, to be a high-risk area. And so we are facing smaller-scale attacks that are harder to detect day to day to day. The alarming longer-term phenomenon we have to be concerned about with ISIL is any time a terrorist organization with that level of resources, in excess of 30,000 fighters, with foreign fighters pouring into Syria, and that level of depravity establishing territory, an attempt to establish a caliphate in Iraq and Syria, so that this very large, dangerous terrorist organization has a place to base, train, send operatives, that is a huge homeland security concern to a number of nations. Yeah. And so that is the longer-term phenomenon that we see and we're very concerned about, which is why we're taking the fight to them, in addition to the basic homeland security concerns that we see day-to-day.
All right, now let's talk about CVE, countering violent extremism. I think the first question I have about that, which you hear from many, many Republicans, and is a criticism of the term itself. Why do you and the Obama administration describe this as violent extremism and refuse to use the phrase Islamic extremism? What is the distinction that you're trying to get at there?
I believe strongly, and I hear this over and over again from Muslim leaders in this country, that to refer to ISIL as Islamic extremism concedes too much. It dignifies them as occupying some part of the Islamic faith, which is about peace. And so when I go into these CVE engagements...
Tell everyone what you're talking about with the CVE engagement.
Yeah, it's called countering violent extremism here domestically.
So you're going around, you're meeting with Islamic communities in the United States.
Yes, and I did not invent this. This is something that our department, the FBI, and other parts of the federal government have been doing for some time, but I've taken it on as a personal mission. We go to these roundtables, these discussions with groups anywhere from 50 to 100 people. I've been to Boston, Brooklyn, New York, Northern Virginia, Maryland, Chicago, Columbus, Minneapolis, Los Angeles, Houston. And I want to get to every single metropolitan area in this, major metropolitan area in this country that has a significant Muslim population, to talk to Muslim community leaders about helping us if they see somebody going in the wrong direction. As Jim said last night, it's almost always the case that there is someone else who knows. And we have seen success stories where somebody in the community has intervened, and we need to see more of that. And so we go out, we do these things, and it's a two-way conversation where people in the community have lots of issues they want to talk to me about. I am responsible for the enforcement of our immigration laws, for example, and things that happen at airports. So they want to talk to me about things, and I want to talk to them about helping us help them in our public safety, homeland security efforts. And the message is, it's your homeland too. And I think people hear that message. And I think we've made a lot of progress in building trust, building relationships. I almost always have the local sheriff, the local police chief with me in the local SAC of the FBI office. And we're building trust. We're getting some pushback.
Yeah.
There is actually a CCVE effort out there, countering violent extremism initiative. And as Mike Leiter pointed out to me yesterday, that's how you know you're having an impact. And so we are making progress. I'd like to see us take our efforts to the next level. We talk a lot about the counter message. The counter message actually does exist, but it needs a larger microphone. Counter messaging is not something domestically for the government, but it does exist. There are some imams that have done some good work. It needs a larger platform. It needs a larger microphone. And so one of the things I want to do in this next phase is engage, frankly, foundations, philanthropies, to support this kind of effort here in the United States. We want to engage the high-tech sector in helping us with the messaging. But I think CVE is fundamental to our efforts. Now, at these engagements, whether it's Somali Americans in Minneapolis or Syrian Americans or Pakistani Americans, the one thing I hear consistently, irrespective of the socioeconomics of these groups, and they're not a monolith, is ISIL is trying to hijack my religion. We can't let them do that. And so if you call it Islamic anything, we are dignifying this terrorist organization with occupying a part of the Islamic faith, which Muslims in this country, I know, push back very strongly on. So if I went into these communities calling it Islamic extremism, I'd get nowhere.
But aren't we isn't the government denying the fundamental religious component of this kind of extremism by not using the word Islamic?
ISIL.
I mean, your analysts, I assume, in the government are trained to understand the religious dimensions of this kind of violence. Why? To some people, it sounds like political correctness, and that we're missing an important component of what's going on if we don't describe this, if we don't understand the religious component.
I could not disagree more. ISIL would like us.
It is called the Islamic State.
Yes, and many people believe that they do not not deserve to be called Islamic or a state.
Yeah.
ISIL, I think, would like to be referred to as Islamic extremism, because it therefore concedes that what they are saying and what they are doing occupies legitimately some form of Islam, which is about peace. And so here domestically, I think it's critical that in order to build our relationship and build our level of cooperation with the Islamic community here, we have to say to them, look, we understand that what this depraved terrorist organization is doing is no part of your religion.
Some people believe that what we're witnessing in the Middle East, though, is a civil war within Islam. That sounds like it's not your view at all.
Look, I think ISIL believes that what it is doing is driven by their religion. The Muslims that I know and that I've spent a lot of time with in this country believe just the opposite. And so it's important to remember that Islam is one of the largest religions in the world. And this band of terrorists and criminals does not represent what the overwhelming majority of Muslims in this country believe Islam is all about.
Let me ask you about violent extremism in general and whether we overstate the threat from jihadism in the United States. We had two very, very tragic events recently, one in Chattanooga and one in Charleston, of course. Mm. The New York Times recently reported on some very interesting findings from the New America Foundation that showed that since 9/11, there have been more attacks by violent extremists who were white supremacists than people who were Islamic extremists, which I think challenges a lot of the assumptions, especially at a conference like this. How does DHS grapple with homegrown extremism that, according to the Times and according to some of this reporting recently, local law enforcement is actually more concerned about than anything coming from the Middle East?
Local law enforcement should be concerned about mass shootings, rampages, multi-victim acts of violence. A lot of our grant making in DHS, we put out over $2 billion a year in grants to state and local law enforcement, goes to readiness, first responder equipment, active shooter training that can be useful in a variety of different mass casualty situations. A lot of the first responder equipment that was used at the Boston Marathon, for example, was funded by our department. But a lot of that same equipment could be just as effective and is just as useful in any mass shooting event, irrespective of the motive. You know, my mission, our mission at DHS is largely protecting our borders, land, sea, and air. Chief Fisher is here. He's our chief of the U.S. Border Patrol. But given how the threat has evolved, we also have to pay attention to the effectiveness of terrorist groups' ability not just to send an operative physically into this country, but to send a message into this country through social media, through the internet. And that is a mission that both DHS and law enforcement must undertake and must be mindful of.
But should the U.S. government be spending more resources on tracking, identifying white supremacist groups or as much? Should we be spending more resources on that than we are right now? If the numbers show that we've actually more Americans have been killed since 9/11 from that sort of threat rather than jihadism?
Look, I believe that we do spend and we do invest considerable resources in tracking violent white supremacist groups, violent domestic-based groups that have an extremist purpose, and we do so very effectively. And we have to. We have to be mindful of that. The cornerstone of our department's mission is counterterrorism. Yeah. And it has evolved to a place where we have to be mindful of the overseas terrorist organization-inspired attack here by a homegrown terrorist here. That's part of our mission. It is, and this goes to the point of your question, given how it's evolving, it is moving more closely to the purely domestic-based act of terrorism.
Yeah.
So there's a mission there for both DHS and law enforcement, obviously.
You were talking about ISIS and controlling territory in the Middle East. The 9/11 report, one of its core recommendations was never, ever should the United States let a group like Al-Qaeda or one of its affiliates or a group like ISIS, which obviously didn't know about at the time, gain territory. Never let it build a state. That's when it has the resources and the capabilities to launch a more spectacular attack against us. You were at the Pentagon when we drew down the troops in Iraq. Ray Odierno said this week that we could have, quote, prevented the rise of ISIS if we had left more troops in Iraq. Do you believe that the Obama administration could have prevented the rise of ISIS?
Well, I don't really have. I don't like to engage in second guessing. I fully support the direction that we have taken in our efforts overseas. I do believe that any time a terrorist organization sets up a caliphate or establishes territory, that needs to be a huge national security, homeland security concern, because it provides the basis for doing a lot of bad things, and it's difficult to root out once they have that kind of foothold.
Do you
The best approach is to keep these guys on the run and hit them where they live and hit them where they train. And we've done a lot of that in the last number of years, and we need to continue to do that.
Is there a military component to defeating ISIS that we have not pursued that you would pursue?
We continue to, through John Allen's good efforts, build and support an international coalition to take on ISIL. We continue through DOD's good efforts to work with the Iraqi security forces to train them. So in that respect, that is the national security military piece of this that is necessary to degrade and defeat ISIL.
I want to ask you a version of the question that Wolf asked Director Comey last night about Iran. Iran, under the current agreement, Iran is about to receive over the next year or two a huge influx of cash from its frozen accounts and the end of sanctions. How, this is the number one state sponsor of terrorism in the world, how, if at all, is DHS preparing for the changes that are about to take place in Iran? A lot of people predict that Iranian hardliners who are not happy with this deal will sort of make a show of aggression. How is DHS preparing for that, if at all?
Well, I'll give you a version of Jim Comey's answer, which is it is a concern. And through our intelligence components in the intelligence community, we keep a close eye on overseas threats that we see are emerging from a number of nations. One thing that strikes me, that I've been at this now for 6.5 years, we have, since 9/11, I believe, come a long way in the level of sophistication of our intelligence community and their ability to track and detect potential threats to our homeland from overseas, to the point where it's very often an exercise between sorting out what's real versus the noise.
Yeah.
And so we have developed good capabilities to detect plotting, to detect efforts to do something bad in our homeland. We do have the problem of going dark that Jim talked about last night, very definitely. And we have to find a balanced solution to that problem. But I think the good news here is that our intelligence capabilities since 9/11, our ability to connect dots is pretty sophisticated.
All right, since you're responsible for...
Which is why I think a number of us are so concerned about how this whole thing is evolving, because we've got to be now concerned about the homegrown threat, which is harder to detect in many respects.
So what's changed? I think you have several trends converging. You've got more actors generating more capability, investing more in this. You've got a perception, I believe, that to date there is little price to pay for engaging in some pretty aggressive behaviors, whether it's stealing intellectual property, whether it's getting in and destroying things, as we saw in the Sony attack, whether it's going after large masses of data, whether OPM being the most recent, but go back to the summer of 14, and we saw a successful penetration of largest health insurance companies in the extraction of most of the medical record and the personal data information that they had. So you've got these things together of more capability, more actors, in a sense, I think, at the moment, that there's not a significant price to pay. And so you see actors, nation states, willing to do more. The last point I make is we generally will spend, I suspect, a lot of time talking about nation states, and I'm the first to acknowledge it tends to shape a lot of the way I spend my time as Cyber Command and as the director of NSA. But I would also remind people probably the single greatest sphere of activity is still criminal if you just look at volume.
But the most sophisticated attacks you've seen so far, most of them, there have been some very sophisticated criminal attacks, Target and Home Depot and a few others. But some of these most sophisticated, and we'll get to OPM in a moment because it was so fascinating, have been state-sponsored. Maybe you can take us into the room a little bit for the debate in the administration last November and December during the Sony hack. The U.S. government, in fairly rapid order, made the decision to name the suspect country, send the president out to basically say it was the leadership of the country was knowing of this, and to make the case that they would pay a price, as you said. This was different from the way you treated almost every other major cyber attack I can think of. I can't remember another one that brought the president to the press room to name another country. So what made the North Korean case different? And tell us a little bit about the debate about the utility of naming them and threatening retaliation.
So first, I was part of that process, but let me just talk to you about what my input was and what my concerns were, and I'll give you some contrary viewpoints because there were people who had different viewpoints in this process. The first thing that I think made Sony unique was just how public it was, in the sense that you had the North Koreans very publicly in the months prior to this, talking about how they were prepared to take action if this film was released. And then the fact that Sony was hacked and a Viper malware was launched internally in their system, which ended up destroying hardware in addition to taking out some of their software and also ended up destroying hardware components in their systems. That was all a matter of public record.
And most people here probably aren't aware of what the destructive nature was. Maybe you can do a beat more on that. They lost about 70% of their computing capacity. Is that right?
Right. I mean, huge impact for them. And, for example, on the trivia side, their phone system and their network structure were intertwined. So when they lost their network structure, they lost their phone accesses in their offices. So the fact that North Korea had talked about taking direct action in a coercive nature. They clearly were trying to use cyber as a vehicle to achieve a coercive impact. Hey, don't do this. So one of my concerns was this time it was a movie. What if the next time a nation state, a group, an individual, an actor decides, I don't like a U.S. policy. I don't like a U.S. product. I don't agree with this particular position taken by a company or taken by an individual. If we start down this road, this is not a good one for us as a nation. Another thing that I thought was different in this case was the fact, significant issue. Sony has talked about the fact that, let's talk for a minute about what was taken. The North Koreans, once they penetrated Sony's computer system, extracted all their emails, made a matter of public record because they posted it online, Sony's internal salary structure, sensitive emails among leadership talking about their views on working with particular artistic talent, on how you would get certain individuals to cooperate with the company in the making of different films, for example. Hey, here's what they tend to like. This is the way to get them to partner with us. You had emails released about disclosures, conversations between members of the corporation, internal views about policies about each other. You had intellectual property in the form of their films for 2015, all stolen. Copies of it all taken, downloaded to them, and made publicly available. I mean, the scale of it, Sony in some ways encapsulated everything we had seen before. Theft of intellectual property, theft of personally identifiable information, destructive activity, the use of a nation state to use cyber as a coercive tool. In the aftermath of all that, you know, my viewpoint was, number one, we cannot pretend that this has not happened. We must acknowledge that it. Number two, I also felt strongly we must attribute this to the actor who did it. And in this case, we also had very high confidence about who exactly it was. This was very high confidence, not only the nation state, but the specific actor within North Korea who did this. The third and final thing, and then I'll kick it back, was my concern was if we do nothing, then one of the potential unintended consequences could be, does this send a signal to other nation states, other groups, other actors, that this kind of behavior is and that you can do this without generating any kind of response? I didn't think that was a positive for the nation. My other concern, quite frankly, was, so if you're in the private sector, you're a company, you're being you're receiving this attention from another nation state in this case. And if the government's not going to do anything, what does this drive the private sector to do? Do we start to get into the hackback? Do you get into cyber mercenaries? Do you get into this idea the private sector believes, well, if I can't count on the government, then I'm going to have to do this myself? And my argument was that is going to be incredibly destabilizing. And quite frankly, it'll complicate my life because the number of actors we're going to have to deal with out there within the cyber arena is really going to proliferate. And it's hard enough as it is now.
Boy, wouldn't you have loved to have heard the conversation among the North Koreans when they saw the salary scales of the Sony executives? Well, you run the NSA. You probably did hear the conversation.
Now you know why David and I have these conversations.
So your concern was that if you let this go by, then you were going to, as you said, encourage others to go do this. But you've had many other attacks on major corporations that were not quite as public, didn't attract national attention because they weren't in the movie-making business, didn't have salacious emails about spoiled actors and actresses, where the U.S. government basically said, you're on your own. There were attacks attributed to Iran, denial of service on banks. There have been attacks on exchanges. There was the attack in which, believed to be China, took some of the designs of the F-35. And in all of those cases, the U.S. government not only didn't make public name, but also didn't sort of announce in some significant way what the penalty will be. At least in North Korea's case, there were some modest sanctions. And as a change of approach?
Well, I think in this case, the difference, what made Sony so unique, was this destructive piece. The other point I would remind you is, remember what the president said when he came out and made the comments where we publicly acknowledged it, we attributed it, and then we talked about consequences. And one of the things he said was, and we will respond at the time and place of our choosing. I think one of the points that we're trying to work is we're trying to generate policy and figure more broadly what's the right way to deal with this challenge, because this is not going to be a one-time factor. Is a one-size-fits-all approach probably isn't optimal, that we need to look at each situation for its specifics and make a decision about what makes the most sense in that particular context.
Apart from those sanctions I referenced, which were announced in early January and attributed to this, has North Korea paid any price for this?
Well, my comment would be it achieved the desired effect, at least in the near term.
Which is to say the North Koreans haven't
seen another one like this.
Haven't seen one like
that. Doesn't mean it couldn't happen tomorrow. First, okay, to acknowledge that. But in the near term, knock on wood, it seems to have achieved at least the near term impact that we were hoping for.
So let's take you to OPM. So
there I was.
There you were.
Another three-letter agency.
Yeah, another three-letter agency. Office of Personnel Management. Always on the forefront of the minds of Americans thinking about the operation of the U.S. government. In fact, some of your colleagues argue that one of the reasons that they weren't paying enough attention to sealing up the records of an organization that keeps the security clearances of just about every federal employee and contractor is that they weren't thinking of OPM as a national security agency. They were thinking of it as a big, boring, bureaucratic record keeper. And I don't even think they knew that they kept a number of their records in the highly defended computer system of the Department of the Interior. to whom they
so
were...
So we're going for laughs
from
in, this,
whom they were,
in this section. Is that my takeaway?
That's
here?
It. So tell us a little bit here. You've made the opposite decision. You haven't, other than General Clapper's reference, there hasn't been an official sort of attribution. There has not been a declaration that the offender here would pay the price. And you could argue that the damage done here was on a vastly larger scale than Sony. I mean, we're talking about millions of personnel records and not just names and social security numbers, but anybody has ever filled out one of these standard forms that, you know, everybody you've ever met, everybody you've dealt with, the names of your kids and right. so forth.
You've ever lived.
Yeah.
Every job you ever had. At first, one of the lessons from OPM for me is we need to recognize that increasingly data has a value all its own, and there are people who are actively out there interested now in acquiring data in volumes and numbers that we didn't see before. So if you go back a couple of years, we had tended to focus on this idea of cyber in many ways as either focused on the theft of intellectual property, research and development, product, market, attempt to achieve market advantage, past decades of research and development effort and take advantage of the hard work of others. And we really hadn't come to the conclusion that perhaps not only is that of concern, but you combine the power of big data analytics and the fact that today the ability to bore through huge amounts of data and find seemingly disconnected and unrelated data points and bring coherent meaning and insight, something that wasn't there in the past. You combine those two things together. One of my takeaways from OPM, and we're looking at this broadly across the government. It's a focus for our team within the Department of Defense. Concentrations of large data now become incredibly attractive. It's not just about this idea of, hey, I want the plans for the F-35. Hey, I want to see what you're doing in acoustic technology. Hey, I want to see what you're doing in the development of advanced dye products, for example, that the world we're coming into now as the target set is getting much, much, from a defensive standpoint, makes the job even more difficult.
So what do you think the objective here was? You said that the data itself is valuable. Valuable for what?
I think it does two primary things for you. Number one, it from an intelligence perspective, gives you great insight to potentially use for counterintelligence purposes. So, for example, if I'm interested in trying to identify U.S. persons who may be in my country and I'm trying to figure out why are they there, are they just tourists, are they there from some other alternative, there's some interesting insights you can draw from the kind of data you're able to take from OPM. The second reason that I think data becomes increasingly attractive is we are watching, in particular at the moment, you see this most common in nation states and the criminal sector, where you're seeing actors use their insights about people as individuals to tailor products in the form of emails that seem to you as a user so appropriate that you would receive it. It's from somebody I know. It's a topic that I really care about. It's an issue that I've been really focused on for a long time. As a vehicle to actually get you to open an email, click on an attachment, click on a video link, but perhaps unrelated that in the last 9 months, I am watching huge spear phishing campaigns coming out of several nations around the world directed against U.S. targets. They're not unrelated to me.
Are those state-sponsored spear phishing campaigns? Are they private?
You
Are they
see
criminal?
Both. You see both state and criminal entities using it as well. Okay.
So we've just concluded, the United States has just concluded a big nuclear agreement with Iran that, if successful, would freeze their nuclear program for 10 to 15 years. While those negotiations are going on, the Iranians have made no secret of building up a very effective cyber core. They've done at least three or four big attacks that have become public, one on Saudi Arabia, two that we've discussed here already in the United States, in that casino that we talked about. Could you have a situation in the next few years in which the Iranians take the kind of effort that they have put into nuclear, a weapon you can't really use because of the retaliation that happens, and put that focus and effort more in the realm, a weapon that they've shown they can use?
Well, I would argue, regardless of the nuclear piece, we have watched their investment in cyber for a period of time now. This is not a new phenomena, and it's not something that in my mind is tied to this nuclear place. I think they clearly have come to the decision that it represents capabilities and options that they believe are of value to them that potentially generate advantage for them. And so they're investing in it, and it's something we pay great attention to.
So the private industry says they get a lot of data, and frequently FBI warnings, they say, well, these were about things we knew about already because we've seen them in our systems. You have a unique capability, though, that they're not allowed to do, which is, as you can create early warning radar of a cyber nature, put it in networks that are around the world, many of them foreign networks under the authorities that the NSA has, and said about a lot of this during the Snowden disclosures, so that you would have nodes where you would actually see an attack massing. Could be used for an attack. Once you put it in, it's like the port that a doctor might put in to both examine a patient and apply a treatment. So to the degree that you can tell us, how active are you in putting this early warning radar in networks around the world? Critical is that in being able to determine whether an attack's coming in? Can you do it without it?
So clearly, we think it's an important part of the strategy. Specifically, we have said NSA will use its foreign intelligence mission to generate insights as to what key cyber actors around the world are doing. And the idea is, rather than just waiting at the point of termination, if we can get ahead of this problem set by getting insights at the point of origin where the attack is coming from before it originates, that we can provide indications and warning to give both the government and the private sector a heads up. Here's what it's going to look like. These are the kind of, we call it tactics, techniques, and procedures. This is what you're going to see. This is how you can best structure your defense to defeat it. Mm-hmm. Between NSA and U.S. Cyber Command, we try to do all of that with the private sector. Partnering, the final point is, remember, we're just one part of a much broader enterprise, both externally outside the government as well as internally in the government. DHS, the Department of Security, and the FBI, being probably within the U.S. government, are two biggest partners in that regard on the cyber defensive side.
And how successful is the early warning? Think of the North Korea Sony case. You were able to build a case very quick. It was North Korea, and you said you even knew the actors within North Korea. But I take it you didn't see that attack massing, or you would have done something about it before.
In some cases, it works very well. In other challenges, as I said, you need to have both ends of this trend. In an optimal world, it's defense in depth. You want to work both sides of this. And so one of the reasons why the partnership is so important, using NSA resources to monitor U.S. networks. That's not our mission. It's against the law. That's not what we're here for. But on the other hand, I do want to create a partnership where we're able to share information with each other. So in this case, one of the things that frustrated me about Sony, for example, was Sony goes to the U.S. government. We come to the determination that Sony was a criminal act. Designated as the lead, FBI, NSA says, hey, we could use your analytic help. Will you partner with us in working with Sony? Sony, I thought, to their credit, I give them big accolades in this regard. They gave us everything we asked for. So we said, in order to generate the insights we need, here's the kind of detail we need. Sony did everything that we asked. We were able, the results of that, to generate insights relatively quickly about, okay, here's what we're seeing. But my frustration with Sony was, hey, this is great, but the horse is out of the barn. It really we need to be if I'm doing this after the fact. Why can't we have this kind of dialogue prior to the attack, so to speak?
And is one of the reasons that people have been concerned about naming China, other than your boss, in the case of OPM, is that espionage involve activity that NSA, Cyber Command, would do in response, because espionage is part of what the mission is. And therefore, that's in a category of basically permitted kind of or understood actions between countries. So you may be able to put these warning in, but you may not want to blow the whistle because you may not want to create a precedent in which espionage is not acceptable on either side.
I mean, I think it's clearly part of the discussion, but I'm not going to sit here and tell you, hey, it's the overriding factor that has led to the current to review this and assess what the right long-term way ahead is. I'm not going to argue that that's the factor that has brought us where we are today, but I won't deny for 1 minute that it's a factor that you do think about in any regard. So what are the implications on our friends and allies? We thought about that when we were responding to Sony. We think about it in the OPM scenario. It's a factor we think about in every situation.
When I travel around particularly in Europe, I run into a lot of government officials whose desire to cooperate with you, either on the NSA side or on the Cyber Command side, has been dramatically limited by the Snowden revelations. In Germany, just a few weeks ago, there was another outbreak of revelations that suggested that the U.S. government was listening in on employees of the chancellor's office, not the chancellor herself. Of course, there had been an earlier disclosures concerning that. So tell us how you these partnerships, when you've got countries from Germany to Brazil to many others who are talking off the Internet to keep you out.
Mind you, I reflect the statement by Chancellor Merkel herself in the last few weeks. Even as we're working our way through issues of concern between our nations, the intelligence relationship between our nations remains critical. She has specifically said in the last month or so the relationship with NSA is security, that the information NSA provides to Germany and as well as a broad set of partners around the world. There's a reason why we continue to have relationships. I haven't lost a single partner because of any of this. Why? Because we still generate value for them in terms of the information we share with them. And that is critical, I think, for both of us.
Have you changed the way you look at targeting American allies and partners, though? Do you now go through the lists and say, gee, if this operation becomes public, the kind of damage it's going to do to us may be greater intelligence?
And so the aspect of cybersecurity in that.
Well, because you've got partners who are telling us, no matter what Chancellor Merkel said, you've got partners who are publicly saying we're going to hold hearings, we don't want this level of cooperation, or we want to create our own part of the Internet that is separated off from everybody else.
So I remain confident in our ability to partner with nation states around the world, as long as we generate value that helps them. Okay. Without that value, I'd be the first to admit that changes the dynamic. But because we're able to generate value and insight, which helps defend their citizens, help defend their interests and ours, I remain comfortable, hey, we'll work our way through all this.
And let me ask the same question about working with your Silicon Valley partners. So when Secretary Carter was out in Silicon Valley for that same speech,
right,
he went out, met a number of Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, said, look, we need your help in ways that we've never had it before. We had it during the Cold War. I'm not sure we have it now. And you've had Apple and Google and others announce encryption techniques that they've said were designed specifically to assure their users that the U.S. government, the Chinese government, the Russians, or anybody else isn't getting into their stuff. So how is that changing the dynamic of your ability to cooperate with
industry? Continue to partner with industry. I'm out in the Valley fairly regularly because, quite frankly, my attitude is, look, we have got to have a dialogue with each other. We have got to work our way through this. We, at its heart, both I would argue particularly on the NSA side, but one of the comments I make at NSA to the workforce is, at its heart, we're that employs technology to defeat technology. And much of that technology on both sides of the equation is developed by others outside the organization. Partnerships are critical to the future for us. And we can't allow the current dynamic to stop. The side for me is most people, have gotten to a position where they're willing to talk. I'd also highlight, if you look at the telephone metadata issue in 215, 18 months ago, I think the discussion largely was, hey, this program is dead. We're never going to do this again. And yet, I think we're able to step back and ask ourselves, so is there value with the appropriately controlled legal framework for NSA to be able to access in a controlled manner for a specific purpose, specific set of rules? Is there value in NSA being able to access that? The decision, law was passed, yes. Difference in the new structure, hey, NSA won't hold the data, the providers will. My attitude was a good example of we can work our way through this and we can get to a position where we can try to address both of the imperatives that face us. Imperatives real quick. The imperatives to me, and they are two imperatives. It ain't one or the other. It ain't about, well, what are the trade-offs you got to make? The rights of each and every one of us as individuals to have an expectation that the capabilities of the government will not be used against us indiscriminately or original to our structure as a nation. At the same time, At the same time, we've got to acknowledge we live in a world right now where there's a lot of groups and organizations out there who had, if forums like this would never exist. The idea that as a private citizen, you could go sit down, talk to a group of senior government or private leaders and ask a question about, hey, talk to me about policy X, Y, or Z. Do you do things this way? Hey, I don't agree. Here's what I see. You'd never see that in this world. And so we've got to acknowledge that there are groups out there who want to destroy what we are and who. And so we've got to figure out how do we meet both these imperatives. And the, you know, U.S. Freedom Act, I think, is a good example of, hey, we can get to a middle ground here.
So, so your middle ground is that the telecoms, by and large, will be holding on to this data, and you'll be able to get court orders from the FISA court or other courts to go get it. Technologically, that's a bit of a trick to pull off. Tell us where that stands right now. How quickly do you think you'll be able to get the U.S. government out of the business of retaining this bulk collected data?
So under the terms of the legislation, we have 179 days from the date the law was passed on the 29th of June. I think the trigger date now is November 29th, 2015. Under the terms of the legislation, we must have transitioned to the new program no later than 29 November, 179 days after the law was passed. So we're in the midst of the process of doing that right now. I'm comfortable that we're going to be able to do it. I have yet to run into a technical problem or a lack of cooperation that leads me to believe, boy, this is going to be problematic. I think we can get there. We can do it in the time frame with the organizations we have been working with previously.
And if you develop a lead of an individual who made contact in the United States or elsewhere with a suspected terrorist, do you believe that having that database spread out on different telecoms now, you'll still be able, as quickly as you were before, to go track down that conversation and figure out?
I mean, there is no doubt there are trade-offs. We got the continued existence of the program. We need to access the data, which I thought was important because I thought it generated value. It's not a silver bullet that in and of itself guarantees we're going to stop everything against the United States. You will never hear me say that. It is a tool that helps us provide insight and when put together with other things, helps us to build a picture. If you're an intelligence professional, if you watch the movies, half the time it's, well, there's this one silver bullet that does everything. In my experience as an intelligence 30 years, it normally doesn't. It's our ability to try to create a more broader picture. So we're going to have to work our way through it. I think we're going to be fine. I just don't really see major issues there. The other thing I liked is the legislation proviso, where if we feel that we're in an immediate threat, authority is granted to the Attorney General to direct that the data be provided to us, but then we have to go back and inform the court. The court has to come back and tell us, do they agree or do they disagree?
A last question for you, and then we're going to open it up. A few years ago, if you came to this conference, you would have heard a lot of people warning against a future cyber Pearl Harbor. I think that was the line that Secretary Panetta used when he gave his first big cyber speech. What we've been discussing here for the past 45 minutes have not been a cyber Pearl Harbor. It's been short of war operations. It's going after a company like Sony to try to stop a movie. It's collecting up vast amounts of data from an ill-protected government database. It's going after healthcare data that may give people insights into many citizens of the United States. But it is not shutting down the cell phone systems. It's not
yet.
Yet. It is not yet.
Yet.
So here's my question. Do you think the threat is evolving into something bigger but perhaps less dramatic than what we first discussed? Or do you think that the threat of turning off vast amounts of infrastructure, the power systems in New York, we had that a day a few weeks ago when you had in rapid succession a problem at the New York Stock Exchange, a problem at the Wall Street Journal on their website, and a problem with United Airlines,
right,
all in the same morning. You must have been thinking, gee, could this be the morning we were worried about?
Is this it?
So tell us which of these you're most worried about and in what order or how you rank them.
Put more broadly, hey, what concerns me? You can see we're watching a steady ratcheting up of activity. If the trends continue the way they are, then I don't think the destructive piece that we saw in Sony is a one-off. We're going to see more of that. I don't think that the theft of, you know, large data segments, not just intellectual property, but large data segments, that's not going to stop. The intellectual property piece will keep going. The criminal piece isn't going to go. As I look, if somebody asked me, so what do you think is going to happen in the next couple of years? I think you're going to see nation states start to create partnerships with the broadcasters as a way to attempt to confuse attribution. So it makes it harder for us to tell policymakers, here's who it was. It was this nation, this particular actor. Because remember, a policy response in broad terms always starts with the first question I always get, who did it? Always starts with who did it. Then it's how did they do it? Why did they do it? So you're going to see nation states attempt to obscure our ability to say who did it.
Through criminal groups?
You'll see criminal groups. I'm already watching that. You'll see other similar kinds of things with other groups. To date, the terrorist world has tended to use the internet as a recruiting tool to disseminate ideology, to generate resources and money. You've heard ISIL publicly talk about this idea about why don't we get into the hacking business? So if you start to see actors out there outside the nation state world suddenly start to think that cyber as a weapons system offers an attractive set of capabilities, that would be really worrisome. Put another way, I believe that during my time as the commander of United States Cyber Command, I will be directed to deploy capability from U.S. Cyber Command to defend critical U.S. infrastructure, either in anticipation of or in the aftermath of a significant cyber event.
You haven't
one
yet.
Of those 16 segments. Not yet, but it's the when, not the if to me.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to the Aspen Institute for giving us permission to use this audio. You need to do more to spread the word about the Lawfare Podcast. Share it, tweet it, talk obsessively to friends about it, send Snapchat messages about it. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan, who used to babysit for me. Thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.